the late Father Richard John Newhouse wrote concerning the end of the modern world by philosopher Romano Guardini. This is not a book to read and then check off one's list of must reading. It is an engagement with a great mind and great spirit who will settle for nothing less than a decision. Upon that decision, many other decisions inexorably follow. Close quote. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College. At the 2017 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Dr. Thaddeus Kaczynski, our academic dean, spoke about Guardini, our current culture, and the decisions we must make. Here is his lecture in its entirety.
I think we've all heard of the Benedict option by now. It's an attractive and plausible strategy for Christians to retain their faith and preserve it, sustain it, and hand it on to the future generations when the culture is at large. Not only is not helping us to do that, but is actively making it just about impossible. The line was drawn, I think, with Rod Dreher at the Obergefell decision to legalize same-sex marriage, although I don't know why people didn't realize this in 1973, was it Roe v. Wade? That should have been a wake-up call. Now we have gendered neutral bathrooms and the like. And so it seems like a plausible thing. Not so much to drop out completely and leave the culture to its own devices, but to not think that the culture is going to help us sustain Christian tradition, and so to repair to our own resources and, as Benedict analogy did with the fall of Rome. Well, you've all read this Guardini section. Does that make the Benedict option seem less possible? It did to me when reading that. And I want to try to explain why a little bit in this talk. I'm going to quote from the late Archbishop Joseph Zasinski, and this is the first quote on your handout. This is from a book he wrote about postmodernity and Christianity. To live the life of Abraham is to be ready at a day's notice to pack the tents, symbolizing everything that is dear to one, and to go to a new unknown place which God will indicate, completely independently of rational calculations or our emotional predilections. To live the faith of Abraham in the cultural context of postmodernity is to be able calmly to pack up the tents of congenial concepts and arguments, not in order to set out on a desert path, but to set them up again in a different context and in a different form, in a place indicated by God. In an Abrahamic testimony of faith, one may not lose heart on account of the wildness of new places or on account of a feeling of loneliness in a foreign landscape. We must constantly seek the face of the Lord, listening carefully to his voice, which could be God and postmodern thought. Oops, is that doesn't sound right. Either a discrete, that's the title of the thing I put in the quote there, which could be either a discreet whisper or a delicate breeze. We need to love God more than the logic of convincing deductions and the collection of respected authorities, to which we like to refer in times of difficulty. We need to accept the provisionality of contingent means in order that the divine absolute might all the more clearly reveal in them his power. Only then does the contemporary wandering Aramaean reveal the style in which, amidst the darkness of our doubt, flashes the light of the great adventure of our faith. We need to accept the provisionality of contingent means.
When did he write this?
Maybe 10 years ago. This is a more recent than Guardini. Yeah, this is a recent work. To me, what he's getting at doesn't sound redolent of the discourse of Benedict option. Now, I think Benedict option is not the solution, but it's an important means. But I think what Guardini is pointing to is more of the solution. Yes,
can you
question.
Quickly summarize what you see your dictation of Benedict option.
The summary of it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, sure. So in general, it's something that's been done before, and homeschooling movement, for instance, has been doing it. It's a kind of recognition that, you know, the culture, the mass culture we're in, and even in some respects, the mainstream ecclesial culture, is not something we could rely upon as Christians to nourish and sustain our faith, especially in a communal setting, and especially a faith that will be vibrant and able to kind of overcome all the challenges to it. So we need to sort of have intentional communities like WCC, sort of a Benedict Option community, where we're explicit in our presuppositions, we're unified in the faith, and we're kind of countercultural. I mean, it's not something new, although the stakes are higher, perhaps. There's a kind of emergency feeling in Rod Dreher, a kind of urgency to it. You know, people need to wake up and realize that the culture is not neutral to Christianity, it's anti-Christian, and the politics too, and the economics, every kind of, the framework itself of the state and all that comes under it is inimical to the faith. It used to speak in Christian terms to us and make like it's our friend. It's now seen to be the naked emperor it's always been, or whatever, stuff like that. So that's kind of the idea.
So it's any option where committed Christians of any stripe would form supportive communities,
yeah,
on any level, everything from discussion groups to parishes of like-minded,
yeah,
people, to living in community, to colleges.
Yeah,
that,
yeah, right? Yeah. And the other thing about it is it's sort of like we're doing that because the new Christendom that will hopefully emerge from that is going to take a few hundred years. It's not going to be the next election, you know. And so we're sort of recognizing that this machine has to just break, and the Christian culture will be there when it does, that kind of thing. I mean, that's the more apocalyptic notion of it, I guess. Not everyone thinks of that, but. So anyway, what I want to do is present another author, Charles Taylor, to give us another insight into what Guardini is getting at from a philosophical perspective. Charles Taylor will teach us that there's a way, sense in which modernity is inescapable existentially, for good or for worse. Guardini will then build on that and tell us that what we need is intimate union with God in himself, a kind of naked, he talks about dogma being felt in this absolute sense, right? Naked faith, hope, and charity without cultural, political, or ecclesial props. I think he's telling us that that's not just an option, but an absolute obligation and necessity to have that kind of mystical Christianity, mystical union with God. So I hope these two authors will not just answer our questions, but show us what we need to show us that we need to keep asking them. For such honest and courageous inquiry is precisely what in the end will defeat the evils we're facing. Evil is sort of bound up with the death of questioning, as I've mentioned before. Alistair McIntyre wrote once, quote, "We have within our social order few, if any, social milieus." This is not on the handout, sorry. We have within our social order few, if any, social milieus within which reflective and critical inquiry concerning the central issues of human life can be sustained. This tends to be a culture of answers, not of questions. And those answers, whether secular or religious, liberal or conservative, are generally delivered as though they meant to put an end to questioning. So Charles Taylor is a renowned Canadian Catholic philosopher. He wrote a book called A Secular Age, about 900 pages. And when I mean pages, though, it's like the ink is, you know, the words are small, too. So it's one of the many profound and trenchant descriptions he offers for the meaning of the book's title, A Secular Age. This one is especially helpful. Here's your quote page. "There has been a titanic change in our Western civilization. We have changed not just from a condition where most people lived naively in a construal, part Christian, part related to spirits of pagan origin, as simple reality, to one in which almost no one is capable of this. But all see their option as one among many. We all learn to navigate between two standpoints, an engaged one in which we live as best we can the reality our standpoint opens up to us, and a disengaged one in which we are able to see ourselves as occupying one standpoint among a range of possible ones, and with which we have in various ways to coexist. The shift to secularity in this sense consists, among other things, of a move from a society where belief in God is unchallenged and indeed unproblematic to one in which it is understood to be one option among others. A secular age is one in which the eclipse of all goals beyond human flourishing becomes conceivable. The eclipse of all goals beyond human flourishing becomes conceivable. Or better, it falls within the range of an imaginable life for masses of people. What we share is what I've been calling the imminent frame. The different structures we live in, scientific, social, technological, and so on, constitute such a frame in that they are part of a natural or this-worldly order, which can be understood in its own terms without reference to the supernatural or transcendent. Note, end quote. Note here that this characterization of modernity as a secular age and as an imminent frame is non-ideological and non-judgmental. It's sort of a description, kind of a sociological description. It's neither the rigid denunciation of the religious traditionalist nor the insouciant glorification of the secular humanist. Rather, Taylor identifies secular modernity as something more akin to a new paradigm or consciousness shift. Neither moral nor immoral, true nor false, good nor evil, pro-Christian nor anti-Christian, it's not to be identified with exclusive humanism, meaning that the imminent frame is the truth, there is no transcendent. It's not saying that. That's not what the imminent frame is. It's not exclusive humanism, it's not managerial liberalism, it's not fascist fundamentalism on the one hand, it's not resurgence of public religiosity, the priority of liberal democracy and human rights, and the intolerance of religious tolerance on the other. For these, according to Taylor, these kind of things are like spins on this, the spins people put on it. They are the diverse ideological interpretations, the structures of thought and practice that have been built upon with the help of secular modernity's peculiar consciousness. Quote, an age or society would then be secular or not in virtue of the conditions of experience of and search for the spiritual. See, what he's getting at are the conditions for human existence have changed. According to Taylor, secular age or secular modernity or imminent frame is an ineluctable mode, background, and context for all thought and practice in the contemporary West, rather than any particular expression of it. It's a deeper thing than a mere ideology. It's existential. We encounter it deep within our lived experience of reality before we had the chance to even reflect or interpret it. It is not so much the reflective philosophical description or account we give ourselves of a more fundamental pre-philosophical and pre-reflective experience, but it is itself this fundamental experience embodied in the warp and woof of our lives in such a way that the attempt to disengage or extricate ourselves from it is like trying to escape reality itself. Because secular modernity is so intimately bound up with our experience of reality, it serves as the background to and structure of the very form and content of our thinking, akin to the way grammar and rhetoric is the background to and structure of the matter and expression of our words. So just to give you an example, one of Taylor's examples is the buffered self. He says that in the Middle Ages, up to maybe 1500, that the sort of default position was that your identity, your self, they didn't use the word self, your soul, your person, it was always already open to influences, aerial, you know, like in The Tempest. The world was enchanted and you were certainly a distinct being, but you were kind of a porous self. You were porous to the many spiritual, the spirits, you might say, good ones and bad ones. Now you could protect yourself with saints' prayers and sacramentals, but it was a way, you know, I mean, there's still some of this today, right? But the difference is that this was the default position for the Christian West. The default position now, especially post-Freud, for example, is the buffered self. So you can have a buffer, and you could give it to yourself to make sure that you're autonomous, self-sufficient, unaffected. If you choose to open that buffer, you can, to spiritual influences, but you're in control. That's unheard of in the pre-modern world. And that's not so much an idea about the self, it's the way we conceive ourselves. And then you can sort of, well, he spends 900 pages telling us how that happened. So although we can think about and thus gain some distance from this background and structure, abstracting and talking about the history of ideas, reading a book like Taylor's, we can't entirely transcend it. Now this is a radical claim, kind of scary, I guess. I think there's one short and powerful demonstration, though, of it. Ask yourself this question. Do you experience Christianity in a naive manner? That is, in the way a small child raised within a sheltered, integrally and robustly religious home might experience it. Is it for you just the way things are, immune to all experiences of some other possibility? Can you completely avoid being disengaged from your naive experience of what is and must be, losing all awareness of what might be and what might not be? It is even possible for a religious child today to retain this sort of naivety nowadays. What I'm describing is not the perennial age, an age in different capacity of human reason to abstract from one's lived experience and entertain other possible philosophical and theological accounts of reality through one's imagination and intellect. Everybody can do that with enough training and leisure time in any age. If that were the case, there'd be nothing new in secular modernity. For even the most sheltered and parochial medieval peasant could thereby escape from the Christianity he imbibed with his mother's milk, given enough training. What does seem radically unique to secular modernity, as Taylor argues, is an entirely new incapacity to experience the reality of a particular worldview in a naive way. That is, without the consciousness, maybe in the background, but still there, of there being some other viable or at least considerable options. So if this is the existential milieu, so to speak, we find ourselves in, and if it's inescapable, then any Benedict option community must reckon with this, and thus not attempt, whatever else it attempts, to escape this mode of consciousness. Such would be futile. No matter how monastic and centered on God our practices and our community is, we simply cannot get back to the naive theistic consciousness of the medieval man. So I think, you know, traditional mass is great, you know, it's good to go to it. You're just not going to experience the traditional mass in a traditional way. In fact, you're going to experience this as one of your options. Okay, it doesn't take away its effects and its beauty, but, well, it means something that you're not actually experiencing it. I mean, even before the new mass, people experienced the old mass differently the way we do. It was just the mass. Now, because we have these two options, it changes a lot. You become more self-conscious when you go to a rite. I'm at the Latin mass, you know, or I'm not at the Latin mass. What's that? Yeah. And I just think this is not, I'm not condemning this, it's just something to recognize, you know. It's a very modern way to be a traditionalist, if you think about it. So, if this is the case, then there's a sense, a very serious sense, in which we are in exile from Christendom, you know, and we maybe will always will be to some extent, or at least the old style Christendom. We're always going to feel the pull of other worldviews and social imaginaries, as Taylor calls them. And we simply have to accept the fact, but maybe not the normative good nature of, the deep pluralism of our age. Even if it's a pluralism that cloaks, I think, in many ways, homogeneous and stultifying immanentism, materialism, liberalism, and individualism. In other words, oh, we're all diverse and everything, except every opinion's the same. They're all options that no one knows are true. And so, yeah, you can have a lot of diverse opinions, but they're publicly insignificant or something. I mean, that's really liberalism. Okay. In other words, what Taylor's telling us is the Benedict option is sort of impossible if what is meant by that is a return to medieval consciousness through creating small-scale communal participation in traditional religious, cultural, and familial practices. We're free to, and we should, especially now when it's spiritually, morally urgent to do so, we should create what we take to be anti-modern, meaning anti-relativistic, materialistic, anti-mechanistic, whatever you want to say these ideologies are. We should try to create these things. And we should resist and reject the constructs of others on secular modernity, especially the mass culture we're in of egoist liberalism, or egoist eroticist liberalism, however you want to talk about it. We must remember, though, that even if we do this, they are erected from within and by virtue of the pre-constructive consciousness of secular modernity. So we're in it. We're not getting out. No one gets out of here alive. Did Jim Morrison say that or something? Okay. All right, so now on to Guardini. So I hope you see the relevance of Taylor for Guardini. It's okay. In his terrifyingly profound and profoundly terrifying book, I think that's a good way to describe The End of the Modern World, written in 1956, the great Catholic German theologian, great influence on Cardinal Ratzinger. I mean, you know, if you've ever read Guardini's other works, The Lord is like the best book of Christian meditation you'll ever find. He's written books on the liturgy, profound books on history of ideas, Christian anthropology. He's just a polymath and one of the most influential and greatest, but not really well known for whatever reason, even in Catholic circles. So here's the handout. The New Age will declare that the secularized facets of Christianity are sentimentalities. This declaration will clear the air. The world to come will be filled with animosity and danger, but it will be a world open and clean. As unbelievers deny revelation more decisively, as they put their denial into more consistent practice, it will become the more evident what it really means to be a Christian. At the same time, the unbeliever will emerge from the fogs of secularism. He will cease to reap benefit from the values and forces developed by the very revelation he denies. He must learn to exist honestly without Christ and without the God revealed through him. He will have to learn to experience what this honesty means. Nietzsche has already warned us that the non-Christian of the modern world had no realization of what it truly meant to be without Christ. The last decades have suggested what life without Christ really is. The last decades were only the beginning. So Guardini described a world in the 50s, similar to the one Dreyer describes now, which is one of a neo-pagan totalitarianism that's no longer tolerating any threats to its secularist, atheist, and humanist dogmas, one in which Christians and other theists are called to brook no compromise and live out their faith all the more integrally and heroically. But I think Guardini's prescription for action is something at once more bracing and consoling than Dreyer's. Quote, "Nothing but the free union of the human person with the absolute through unconditional freedom will enable the faithful to stand firm, God-centered, even though placeless and unprotected." Placeless and unprotected. Free union of the human person with the absolute through unconditional freedom. He talks about that obedience as well. He goes on, quote, "Loneliness and faith will be terrible. Love will disappear from the face of the public world, but the more precious will be that love that flows from one lonely person to another, involving a courage of the heart born from the immediacy of the love of God, as it was made known in Christ. Perhaps love will achieve an intimacy and harmony never known to this day," Guardini says. So it seems to me that Guardini sees no real possibility for safe havens of Christian culture. And even if we created them, and we should, God is calling theists and Christians, but anybody who senses God, I think, is being called to this, to a higher level of faith, obedience, and trust, a kind of unshakable, naked union with God. People will have to have this and show it forth wherever they go and to everyone they meet. Like Christ, we and our future Christian generations will have nowhere to lay our heads, it seems. So what Taylor and Guardini are telling us is both much worse and much better than Dreher's depiction of our situation. It's worse because although the Benedict option is a crucial strategy for theists, it very well might not be possible. If Taylor is right, the immanent frame is our permanent home, and if Guardini is right, our situation is a gift, a priceless treasure. For God will give each of us who ask for it the grace to endure the darkness, barbarism, and the loss of our customary, sensible, and cultural signs of God's love and presence. We'll all be able to be like Abraham, going out into the unknown and discarding whatever came before and whatever propped us up before psychologically, spiritually. Or at least, I don't know about discard it, not rely on them as much as we did, perhaps. Have a more looser grasp on them, maybe. Be ready to discard them when we need to encounter experience that requires a creative rapprochement with someone that is going to require a kind of new way of speaking or acting. But always being ready for that, right? We will emerge with our idols and crutches and safety nets broken and useless so that we will be able to know God as he is and not just as we think of him and experience him, but as he is, and be conduits for his inexorable love, which will conquer all and save all. David Walsh, the political philosopher, once wrote, quote, "Only someone who has broken out of the restricted horizon of ideology can see clearly what has been left behind. And only those who have fully contemplated the abyss can be sure of having attained the spiritual truth capable of overcoming it." End quote. We can surely try to opt out of the decaying culture and to shore up theistic culture in small enclaves of like-minded devotees of tradition and the transcendent. But whatever we do, we must do the one thing necessary, as Mary did at the feet of Jesus. While Martha was busy with other things she thought more important, Mary knelt and adored Christ. We must all become mystics now, in intimate and real contact with God, so we could be his hands, heart, and voice in our ever-darkening world. The great German theologian Karl Rahner once prophesied, "The Christian of the future will be a mystic or he will not be at all." So I'll close with a recent quote from a recent WCC graduate, Carolyn DeSalvo. She wrote in a paper, we had a course on modernity and postmodernity in humanities class. This was the ending of her paper. In conclusion, she says, "Living in the modern era is a gift. Despite the broken traditions, abolished communities, and heap of worn-out philosophies, this era is still a gift. In one way, man can no longer distract himself with human constructs. They have all failed. And anyone who lives in denial of this failure will be forced to face tragedy at some point, like the grandmother in Flannery O'Connor's story, Good Man is Hard to Find, even if that point only comes at his or her own death. In another way, man is called to even more intimate encounter with God as a result of this wasteland." She's referring to T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland and Our Wasteland. "Quite literally, we have been placed in a society that purges us of pride and confidence in human accomplishment. The disparity of the wasteland calls for deeper love and communion, but God provides a more intimate way of encountering himself to overshadow this disparity. And this is a gift." Thank you.